For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Martin McCloskey on fire. This is Mark McCloskey on fire.
Not getting no down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down. Not getting no down, but I get up again. You're never gonna keep me down.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mark McCloskey, Mark McCloskey on fire, and continuing with the theme that we've been talking about for the last year and a half. Every single word that you hear in mainstream media, every single word that comes out of a politician's mouth is pretty much guaranteed to be the exact opposite of the truth. Because whenever there is truth out there, the government does everything in its capacity to stifle it and to kill it and to replace it with lies. And if you have the guts, if you have the force of will and the intestinal fortitude to tell the truth, the government is going to come after you with both guns loaded. And we have on the program today a young man who's running for Congress in West Virginia who had the audacity to blow the whistle on somebody named Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. And so I'd like to welcome to the show today Mr. Nate Kane. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on, Mark.
Well, so you've borne the brunt of the federal government coming down on you for attempting to tell the truth.
It was not something that I'd really want to do again, but... You end up in these situations where you're tested, and that's where you find out who you are and what you're really made of.
Yeah, and so tell us a little bit about your background. You're an Army veteran. You've had a cybersecurity business, you've had what, top secret clearance for 26 years or something like that?
Yep. Just 27 now. I started off a U.S. Army, and I got out and started working for the Navy. And I did a little bit of time as a contractor with Defense Information Systems Agency, and then a couple years as a Navy contractor. And then eventually, I went and became a Navy civil servant. And then from there, went on to the Marine Civil Service. And I was working for MAR4 Cyber. And that was pretty exciting. That was actually going after hackers who were hacking our national critical infrastructure. As part of what they call a DCI hunt team or a black team. And we were detached to NSA, where we were trained in, basically cyber warfare and cyber defensive operations. That was probably the most exciting job I had. But I only did it for a couple of years before I got an offer from the FBI to go work for them as a contractor, making twice my salary. So it was pretty hard to turn down.
Oh, yeah. So what were you doing for the FBI then?
So they hired me as a cybersecurity subject matter expert. They had a system that they were deploying for their vulnerability management that I was an expert in. And I had deployed it in a large scale with Pearl Harbor Navy Shipyard and with several satellite sites. And so that's why I was hired. And then plus, this extra skills that I had in cyber defensive operations, that was kind of a bonus. And so the team that I was on, they were basically part of, they had two functions. They had an engineering side and then they had the pen testing side. And so they were, I think, hoping to use some of my pen testing skills as well. So that's how I got, hired at the FBI. Went through a pretty rigorous, interview. It was a panel interview. I got asked a lot of really tough questions. And because I had just finished NSA's cyber core training in their school, it was all really fresh in my head. And so I nailed the interview. And when I started there, I was very excited. I mean, I had no reason to think ill of the FBI. And I thought, wow, this was going to be, kind of the peak of my career. Yep. At that point.
What years are we talking about here? Give us a time reference.
So this would have been about 2016.
Okay. An interesting year in American politics.
Yeah. And, and of course, at that time, there was a lot of talk about the, Hillary Clinton email server. There was talk about, Uranium One and those types of things. And the you had the intelligence committees that were investigating some of these things, Devin Nunes being one of them. But, I kind of just stuck to my job and my focus, which was, working on on enterprise-wide deployment of this vulnerability management system. And until one day I came in and I overheard a conversation that I wish I had not heard, but it was a discussion about some transcripts from a conversation on the seventh floor with the senior leadership at the FBI that somebody had come across in my division. And in these transcripts, words like they were talking about the investigation into Hillary Clinton, and words like treason were being thrown around. And somebody made the comment, this is so big it can bring down the government. And then there was a discussion about what to do about it, and the determination that they were going to shut down the investigations into Hillary Clinton on the basis of, you know, fear that she was going to be the next president. And so they didn't want retribution, you know, and having their careers ended.
Oh, so, they weren't worried about Hillary not getting elected. They were worried about her getting elected and then barbecuing them for having told the truth.
Exactly.
So what did you find out? Did you dig into it?
Well, so when I heard this, you know, I couldn't just ignore that. I've taken a sworn oath, you know, three times to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And we often think of those foreign enemies, but we don't really, you know, ponder the fact that we do have domestic enemies. And, you know, a claim of treason is a pretty serious, that's a pretty serious claim. So I had to go and look, and, you know, I had a top secret clearance. I had been read on to multiple programs. I had access to the FBI net, which is their classified network. And so I went and I did some searches in their database, and I never did find those transcripts, although they are talked about in some of the work that was produced by John Durham when he did his report. On page 78, it talks about the information that I eventually turned in, along with the conversations that were being had that, you know, I referenced. But in there, what I did find was I didn't find these transcripts because they'd probably already been compartmentalized by that time. Mm-hmm. But I found a dump of evidence from three different field offices. You had the Little Rock, Arkansas field office, the New York City field office, and the Washington field office. They were all doing separate investigations into Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation and CGI Global and several other, you know, characters that were associated with her. But there were four major crimes that were listed in these suspicious activity reports that had been produced by the U.S. Treasury, and then they had been received by FinCEN, which is the, you know, FBI's Financial Crimes Division. They were looking at them on the basis of money laundering, public corruption, securities and exchange fraud, and terrorism financing. Well, and so these were...
Go back. But, I was just going to, since this has happened some years ago, a lot of this involved the Uranium One deal, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it was all centered around the Uranium One deal and several other pay-to-play schemes, essentially, that had occurred while she was Secretary of State.
And to refresh the audience's recollection, Uranium One was a company which was purchased by the Russians and took control of 20% of the United States uranium asset. True?
Yes. So Uranium One was a Canadian mining company. They had a contract with the U.S. government to process 20% of our uranium supply chain. And Rosatom was this Russian energy company that had sought out to buy Uranium One. Now, there's a very strict process whenever it comes to national security. There's a committee that has to sign off on purchases like that, and that's called the CFIUS Committee. It's the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, was the chairman or chairwoman of that committee. And not only that, but Robert Mueller, who was the FBI director at the time, he was also had a role. He had a non-voting role on that board, and his job was to notify them if there was any kind of national security issue. So the documents that I found, these were already assessed by FBI analysts, and they had already determined a high credibility of criminal activity on the basis of those four charges. There was also some other documents too that I also brought out with me that had nothing to do with that at all. One of them had to do with election security, where the FBI had done an assessment. If you'll remember, after 2016, the Democrats were, you know, they were crying wolf, saying, "Oh, you know, Trump, you know, the election was stolen. Trump only won it because of the Russia, yeah, and yeah. you know." And so I had an assessment in my hand from the FBI, and this was unclassified, but it was, you know, it was still, I felt it was important. And they certainly had been, Comey had gone before Congress, and I think I felt like he had lied before Congress when being asked about that. They had an internal assessment that had looked at the 2016 election, and it determined that there was no way possible that the Russians could have hacked our election.
But meanwhile, Hillary's in charge of selling 20% of our uranium to the Russians.
That's right. And then on top of it, there was another document I walked out with that had evidence that the FBI was contracting with the Southern Poverty Law Center to help them identify homegrown violent extremists. And they were picking out groups like Catholic you know, organizations that were, you know, I think that one of them was an organization that was practicing something called conversion therapy, mm-hmm. which for, you know, people who, you know, are homosexual and want to leave that lifestyle, it, you know, it's counseling sessions and things like that to help them get out of that. And so this Southern Poverty Law Center was basically saying this group, which essentially had a voluntary counseling sessions, was a homegrown violent extremist group because of that.
Yeah.
And the FBI was allowing that to affect their, you know, database. This is why we've seen, you know, the FBI, you know, spying on Catholics, spying on pro-lifers, spying on parents going to school boards because of stuff like that that's happening where they're taking influence from these far left organizations.
Well, and so what did you do with this information? Did you go to Congress with it? Did you try to go public with it?
No, so I had a real predicament on my hands because as far as the uranium one side of it was, everybody that was involved and that was on a lot of these documents, you had that wasn't, you know, had originally investigated the company Rosatom. Rosatom had been investigated in 2009 because they had been suspected of trying to infiltrate our uranium supply chain. And using methods of bribery and kickbacks. Mm-hmm. And so they had evidence of that. Robert Mueller was FBI director at the time. James Comey was the deputy director at the time. Rod Rosenstein was the U.S. attorney involved in that investigation. And now, you know, at the time of my whistleblowing, he was the deputy AG. Who essentially was running things, because remember, Jeff Sessions had recused himself from all things Russia.
Yeah.
And then you also had another man by the name of Michael Atkinson, who at the time of Uranium One, he was the head of the public corruption unit of the FBI. And at the time of my whistleblowing, he was the inspector general who I was supposed to have to go through to blow the whistle using the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act, because as a contractor, I couldn't use just the standard Whistleblower Protection Act that only applied to federal employees. Mm-hmm. I would have to go through the ICWPA, and that meant I had to go through the Intelligence Community Inspector General's office. And so I had a real predicament because basically they were all involved mm-hmm. in the cover-up of Rosatom and Uranium One. So I looked into the law. It took me a while to figure things out and kind of figure out when, you know, I could do this, but the law was very clear. Federal law stated that anybody could bring classified documents to a senior staffer who was part of either the House or Senate Intel committees, because they carry top secret clearances. And I had a courier card, so I could walk out of the FBI with this documentation, but, you know, obviously it has to go into the right hands. I had no intention of going public with anything because it was all classified stuff. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening was I reached out to a YouTuber at the time named Bill Still. He had a show called The Still Report, and he had some very interesting guests on his show, one of who was Bill Binney, who was a NSA whistleblower. And I felt like that he might have, that Bill Still may have connections in D.C. And he also had a Bible verse at the end of his show. And so I knew he, at least, you know, he had some Christian values. And I prayed about it. And I said, well, I guess I'm going to reach out to this guy. And if he responds back, then, you know, I'll use him as a liaison to, connect me to Devin Nunes. Because my fear was that if I called, I figured that the FBI probably would be surveilling, the phone lines over at the Capitol building. I figured that if I walked in, there would be physical evidence on camera showing me walking in. And I really needed to do this, anonymously to the best that I could. It wasn't that I was trying to hide anything, but I knew I was going to need time to get proper protections, in place. And so I contacted Bill. He did respond back. And then we started communicating over encrypted email. And I went down and saw him and told him what this was about. I didn't want to talk about it over the phone.
You know, we're going to have to take a hard break here for just a second. Sure. Can you hang on for the next segment for a couple more minutes? All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is Nate Kane. We'll be right back after a moment.
Fighting against the New World Order. More Mark McCloskey on Fire coming up. For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com. Mark McCloskey on Fire. This is Mark McCloskey on Fire.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back with Nate Kane, whistleblower, candidate for United States House of Representatives for West Virginia. And you were telling us about how you were going to disclose the information that you had learned while working for the FBI.
Yeah, so eventually, basically, we made made arrangements to go through the formal process utilizing the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act. But we went through the Department of Justice IG, Michael Horowitz. I was the first person ever to do that at the FBI. And we ended up getting our stuff into the hands of both the House and the Senate Intel Committees. But 4 months after I finished my disclosure, and there's a lot of really interesting details, but for the sake of time, we're kind of cutting it short. But we ended up getting that stuff out. 4 months later, the FBI raided my home. And I'm pretty sure that the search warrant was illegal because Daily Caller FOIA'd the judge, the federal magistrate, to ask if they were informed I was a whistleblower. And a Clinton-appointed judge put a seal on that answer, and then she sealed her justification for putting a seal on that answer. They raided my home. They doxed me to the public. I was poisoned twice. I had my lug nuts on my car loosened all the way out to the end. I got fired from my job at the VA. It just, everything that, of course, Hillary Clinton was never punished at all. As a whistleblower who did not go to the press, who did not go and leak anything, I was, basically punished and doxed and put out there. So eventually I filed a complaint with the Senate Judiciary and the harassment stopped. But by then, the damage had been done. And so I didn't feel safe living in Maryland anymore. And so I up and moved my family. We sold our house, my wife's dream home, and we moved ourselves to West Virginia, where they actually believe in the Second Amendment, yeah. Where I was able to defend myself and defend my family. And so we moved here in 2020, actually moved in the day after the 2020 election. And after that, about 2 weeks after I moved in, I got called by the White House and asked to work on election integrity. And so I did that for 3 months down in D.C. after the 2020 election, did some work with Judge Gableman because of my background in cyber and in certifying federal IT systems. Ended up an expert witness in multiple lawsuits that were filed, but out of 57 cases brought, not a single court in the land allowed for a single evidentiary hearing. So I came home depressed, and I prayed, said, God, what's going on? And then in November, I saw the same kind of stuff happen again in that election, where you saw Maricopa County have problems, you saw Georgia having problems, Pennsylvania having problems, and I said a prayer. I just said, God, I pray that you'd raise up righteous men and women to run for office. And I heard that still small voice say, what about you? Mm-hmm. And my initial response was, well, hold on a minute, Lord. I meant other righteous people. But, after a few confirmations, I finally decided to obey God. And so I put my hat in the ring. And that's what got me into this race.
Yeah,
I had really no desire to do this. But But now, after having met the people here in West Virginia and really getting out and making so many friends and talking to people and hearing what's going on in their lives, I care about them. I care about the state. I care about our country. And I hope I win so that I can actually, you know, bring some, bring some change to Congress and to, you know, to hopefully to our country and this state.
Yeah, well, you know, the people that don't want to run for office are the people that need to run for office. I got to tell you, you're a perfect example of how everything the left tells you is the exact opposite of the truth. As they're claiming that Trump won the election because of Russian interference, you've got Hillary Clinton selling right out to the Russians. You've got, when you tell the truth and you bring it to light and you do it the proper way and you do it the legal way, they try to crush and destroy you. And there's only, as I say, as a mantra here, there's only one unforgivable crime in America these days, and that's standing up against the left. You can do anything you want to if you're on the left with impunity, but by God, if you stand up against the left, they'll do everything on earth to destroy you.
Well, and I think going through those experiences honestly have prepared me for this. This process of elections, it is a very corrupting process. There's no doubt about it. The money that's involved, politics as usual establishment, it's a very real thing. But, you know, having stood up against that kind of corruption, you know, in D.C. and having had the boldness and the character, you know, to do the right thing, no matter what the consequences to myself, I think, you know, that has, you know, prepared me for this. And I think also shown me that if I do the right thing, I think God will have my back.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, tell us, tell the audience how they can help your campaign and how they can support you.
So the best way that folks can help me is by donating my campaign. I am a grassroots candidate. And, you know, a lot of people say that, but I actually have not taken a single dime from any PAC or super PAC, any corporate PAC. You know, I don't want these special interests having any kind of ownership or control over me. That means that the over $100,000 that we've raised has come in from direct independent donors that have, you know, have basically given their money to me because they believe in what I stand for.
Yeah.
And it's come in from 40 different states. And so, you know, that's the best way people can help me. We're in the last 2 months of this race. We've got to be able to continue to buy signs, buy printed material, buy advertisements, you know, time on radio and newspapers. And, you know, those things cost money.
Yeah.
And so I could definitely use help. Also, if you live in West Virginia or you know people in West Virginia, tell them about me. If you live in the 2nd District, contact my campaign. We'd love to have you come aboard and, you know, help us go do old-fashioned retail politics where we're knocking on doors. We just got back from doing that today in Preston County. We were knocking on doors in Terra Alta and talking to folks and, you know, sharing with them, you know, our thoughts, but also listening to them. I kind of look at this as a listening tour. And so I'm going around and talking to people wanting to hear, you know, from them. And biggest, most important thing people can do is please pray. Pray for our campaign. You know, really pray for all of the candidates that are running and pray for this country that God will have mercy on us and that he will lead righteous candidates into office.
I couldn't have said it better myself. We've had, there's two congressional districts in West Virginia. There's a first and a second. First is Derek Evans. He's been a guest on the show a couple of times. And
great guy.
Now we've got Nate Cain. The two of you guys get elected to the House of Representatives, and maybe we can turn this thing around.
Oh, we'd be a tag team. A tag team going after the deep state. I'll tell you, you know, he's somebody else who's been put through the fire.
Yeah.
You know, and I know him quite well. And we've talked, you know, we probably talk once a week. And but he's a great guy, and I'm rooting for him and praying for him.
All right. Well, thanks for being on the show, and we wish you the best of luck in the primary, and, you know, we'll have you back on again.
Awesome. Thank you so much. God bless.
God bless you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's Nate Cain running for the 2nd District in West Virginia, a true American patriot, a guy who is willing to put everything on the line to tell the truth and get punished for it because, like I say, the only unforgivable crime in America is standing up against the left. We'll be right into, you know, the next fun stuff in my life, and that is that we were driving home last night. My wife and I are in court yesterday afternoon. We're driving home last night, and to get into my neighborhood, you got to go in through a street called Lake, L-A-K-E. And so we get up to the neighborhood, and guess what? This is what we found.
This guy's too stupid to be fair. Oh, I see.
By the way, the skinny girl in the front of that with the megaphone, seems to me I've seen her somewhere before. Oh, yeah. When I was running for the U.S. Senate, she and a mob of BLM, alleged BLM protesters, got into a fight with my overpass rally. It's like the Saturday before the primary election, and actually sent one of my guys to the hospital. And, you know, so I kind of get the feeling that she might be a paid agitator, that she might be out there being hired by people for the purposes of protesting. I'm really confused by this protest because I just drove by it. They were blocking the entrance to my street, and so I couldn't get in. Somebody in a car was trying to block me, so I couldn't drive around it. So I got to, you know, you can see on the video, I see Palestinian flags. So maybe they're protesting in favor of Palestine, but there's also a big banner that said white supremacists, anti-Semites, not welcome here. So I try to figure out how the pro-Israel, against anti-Semitism signs being held up by the same people that are holding up Palestinian flags. But you can't ask a protester what they're protesting against because they're just as dumb as a sack of hammers. Then we found out that, you know, America's favorite moron, Cori Bush, is losing her primary battle against a guy who's currently the St. Louis County prosecutor, a guy named Wesley Bell. There was a fundraiser on my street that night, being held by a fellow lawyer, neighbor of mine, and a fundraiser for, guess what? Wesley Bell. Who's Wesley Bell running against? Guess what? Cori Bush. You don't suppose the illustrious Ms. Bush had anything to do with staging the mini riot in front of Lake last night. But anyway, there was no way to get into my neighborhood. We went out and went to dinner, came back, and as is usually the case, the mob had gotten bored eventually and went away. But this is a precursor. I believe that the left can turn on and off protests as they will. You notice that in the last year, there hasn't been a lot of BLM protesting. Obviously, you know, there have been blacks are no longer the target of evil white policemen. There isn't any racism in this country that needs to be fought against anymore because we had no BLM riots all last summer. And, of course, rioting is a summertime sport. But now I think that they're going to start gearing this up as Trump continues to lead the polls, as it looks like he's going to win the presidential election. I guarantee you that the left is going to turn on protests, create chaos in the streets and pillaging and burning and all these mostly peaceful protest items that they did back in the summer of love, and then blame it all on Donald Trump and say Donald Trump is too chaotic, that chaos follows. That's what Nikki Haley always said, that chaos follows Donald Trump, and we can't have it. We have to have a nice, senile, old grandfather to have be led around by the Easter Bunny. My favorite was last week when Biden was out giving some kind of a fundraising speech, and it's raining outside, and you see him standing outside with one of his handlers holding an umbrella over his head, and somebody shouts out a question to him, "Mr. President, do you agree with Schumer's position on Netanyahu?" President. While the guy with the umbrella then puts his arm around the President of the United States of America, the leader of the free world, and turns him around, literally turns him around and walks him into a door, right? And so here you've got the leader of the free world being led by his valet. You can't make this stuff up, right? But they're actually going to pretend. Well, I got a theory on this, okay? We had a friend of ours that lent a well-known musician by the name of Michael Jackson some money. Now, Michael Jackson couldn't pay his bills at the end of his life, and he didn't have much of a career left, but he still had a lot of fans out there. And so the powers that be decided that Michael Jackson might be more valuable dead than alive, right? And so they decided they would then work him to death. This final concert he was going to put on, this thing that when he was obviously in no kind of physical condition to put on a show, obviously too whacked out and all the drugs he's taken and all the weird lifestyle he had to actually perform. But they figured they could work him to death, and that would solve the problem for him because then, as we all know, artists become much more valuable once they're dead than when they're alive. And sure enough, they work him to death. They put out the video of the show that worked him to death, and they ended up making back all their money. Well, I think that this is what's going on with the Biden campaign right now. I think what's going on is that they've decided that they're going to let Joe Biden have what he wants. I'm a big fan of the old movie Singing in the Rain, and the one character in that, Lena Lamont, who's the movie silent movie star who can't speak, can't think, can't dance, can't sing, but she thinks she's important, and so she always wants to be a big shot. And she says at the end, "Everybody's always doing my talking for me. Tonight I'm going to talk for myself." Of course, it's a complete disaster because she's a complete moron in this character. But that's what they're doing with Donald Trump. That's what they're doing with Joe Biden now. Biden saying, "They're not letting me talk. I want to talk. They're not letting me answer questions. I'm a big boy. I can answer my own questions." And so they're going to let him out there and let him stumble around and do that, "Oh my God, I can't remember where I left my ice cream" look all the time. And until he just absolutely stinking collapses. And then we'll get President Kamala Harris, right? And, you know, if you think Joe Biden's bad, just until you get Kamala Harris in there. But then she's going to have to go spend more time with her family, right? So, you know, they're going to pop in sometime right after the Republican convention, which unfortunately happens before the Democrat convention this year. After the Republican convention, when Donald Trump has already picked his vice presidential candidate, they're then going to spring a late summer surprise where Joe Biden is either dead or so incapacitated that he can't even pretend to campaign anymore. And then they'll spring a new candidate on it. Maybe Big Mike, you know, Michelle Obama, maybe Gavin Newsom, maybe somebody, Governor Whitmer. But it's going to be somebody that will be presented to the public late enough in the game that they're not going to have any public record. They're not going to be able to be questioned. They're not going to have any debates. The last thing that the Democrats want, the last thing that the Uniparty wants, is to actually allow the voting public to know anything about the candidate that they want to have them vote for. Just like all the folks, it's just like I say from the beginning of almost every show, everything they tell you is a lie, and whatever they tell you, the exact opposite, is closer to the truth. When the Democrats always talk about democracy, what they mean is democracy equals when you vote for their candidate. First of all, the parties only let you choose from pre-selected candidates, and then by the time you get down to the level of somebody running for president of the United States, the people you're allowed to vote for are the people that the party wants to get elected. And if you vote for the wrong person, you're subject to arrest, you're subject to losing your job, you're subject to having the FBI break down your front door and steal your computers and your cell phones. And ladies and gentlemen, this is our last opportunity to prevent that from happening. And the only way we can do that is cut through all the BS, vote for Donald Trump, have him come in and clean house. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be right back here after this break, and we'll talk about everything else that's fun and exciting in the news this week.
Fighting against totalitarianism. You're listening to Mark McCloskey on Fire. For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com. Mark McCloskey on Fire. This is Mark McCloskey on Fire.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mark McCloskey, Mark McCloskey on Fire. You know, one of the things that irks me is that there does not seem to be any access to genuine justice anymore in this country. Folks call me up all the time and ask me for my advice on you know, what the likelihood of their getting their rear end in the sling if they do X, Y, and Z. And I always say, if this were 5 years ago, I could give you a definite answer. But now, the legal system is so bass-ackwards. The judges are corrupt around the country. The juries don't care about the facts, and the courts of appeals don't care about the law. And if you're somebody like Donald Trump or Peter Navarro or any of these guys, your goose is cooked, and there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Well, you know, we did something about it. And, you know, when my wife and I got charged with two Class C felonies each for just defending ourselves against a BLM mob back in June of 2020, our Soros-appointed circuit attorney, what we call a DA here, decides to charge us with those felonies, which would cost us 4 years in the slammer and our law licenses and everything else. But because, just like her friend Cori Bush, she's just as dumb as a sack of hammers, she decided to use us in a campaign propaganda, just like Lakeisha James and just like Fannie Willis. So she put out some emails promising the public that if they voted for her, that she'd get even with us. Let me see if I can find this here for you. It's kind of nice. It says, here are her emails. This was put out 3 days before she charged us with felonies. You might be familiar with the story of the people who brandished guns during a peaceful protest outside their mansion. Right. Instead of fighting for the millions of Americans affected by the pandemic, including 31,000 Missourians, President Trump and the governor are fighting for the two who pointed guns at peaceful citizens during the Black Lives Matter protests. Kim needs your help to fight back. Right. Kim's decision to press charges against a couple that brandished guns at peaceful Black Lives Matter. Kind of sounds like Lakeisha James. Lakeisha James, that if you elect me, I'm going to go get Donald Trump. All right. This was 3 days before we get charged. Well, then we get charged. Within 48 hours after that, she sends out another email where she, after saying that she's going to get us, says, "This is what happens when leaders like Kim stand up against a system that elevates the privileged and powerful." And by God, she's going to get us. Well, we filed a motion to disqualify her based on her bias and prejudice and the fact that she was personally benefiting from our prosecution, that instead of seeing whether or not we had committed a crime, we had committed a political crime by taking a position that she could capitalize on. Well, we filed that. We filed a supplemental when it turns out there's even more shenanigans going on. The chief investigator was pressuring the police to change the language, to change the facts. What's my favorite quote from this guy's name was Chris Hinckley. He writes an email or directs the detective in charge of the investigation, quote, "I suggest you very quickly reassess this evidence," meaning find something to charge those McCloskeys with. Well, so we filed the motion to disqualify her, and the court heard it, and the court granted it. And I'll say just a couple of words here from quoting from the court's order. In short, the circuit attorney's conduct raises the appearance that she initiated a criminal prosecution for political purposes. Immediately before and after charging defendant, she solicited campaign donations to advance her personal interests. And the court, in granting our motion to disqualify her, says, "Understandably, Ms. Gardner has every right to rebut criticism, but it appears unnecessary to stigmatize defendant or even mention him in campaign solicitations, especially when she purports to be responding to others. In fact, the case law and the rules of professional conduct prohibit it. These exceptions are real. For these collective reasons, the court grants defendant motion and orders that the circuit attorney shall be disqualified from prosecuting this matter." We got her tossed. We got the entire circuit attorney's office tossed off the case. We did it without her saying anything nearly as directly biased as Lakeisha James said about Donald Trump or Fannie Willis said about Donald Trump. But this is where I get back to, there is no way to expect the law to apply anymore in this country. You can't possibly have anything more egregious than Lakeisha James saying, "I'm going to get Donald Trump." Not that we know that he committed a crime. She says, "We've got to see if he's laundering money. We've got to see where the money is. Not that we think there's a crime here, but by God, you elect me and I will find a crime and I will prosecute him and I will bury him." You know, how she can say that and how she can continue to do that, and how she can prosecute Donald Trump in front of a judge who's then going to strip him of $500 million. In a situation where he has done nothing wrong, where there is no victim, where the banks did their independent assessment of the quality of the real estate that he was putting up as security, lent him money, got paid back with interest, were perfectly happy and testified that they'd do it again, and if he asked for more money, they'd give it to him. And for that, this corrupt system has charged him with $500 million in fines and said, "You got to come up with that cash or you can't have your appeal." Ladies and gentlemen, this is not the United States. This is what we've been fighting about. But it gets worse. We had a justice of the Supreme Court in the case, which we're all familiar with here in Missouri. It's Missouri versus Biden over the government's control of the media and censorship through Facebook and Twitter of what you're allowed to hear and say, and their control over political thought during the last election cycle. What Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson says that the First Amendment, you know, that little thing that we have, the very First Amendment to the Constitution that talks about freedom of the press and freedom of religion, freedom to peaceably assemble and seek redress of your grievances. She says that First Amendment hamstrings government. Well, hell yes, it does. That's what the whole Constitution is there for, is to limit government and to protect us from the power of government. So, hell yes, the First Amendment does hamstring the government. That's what it's designed to do. It's designed to keep the government out of our minds, allow us to assess the facts ourselves, to discuss them freely, to worship the God we choose, and when we don't like what the government's doing, to protest against it and seek redress of our grievances. But she says that the government has a duty to safeguard the public, to take steps to protect by encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. Well, guess who decides what's harmful, right? It might be not you and me. It might be the Uniparty. It might be the party that's got us $34 trillion in debt. It might be the Uniparty that just voted in another $1.2 trillion in spending. It might be the Uniparty that no matter what they say when they run for office, all they do when they get elected is become more powerful. And I've been saying this since I was probably in the eighth grade. The goal of the United States government is to become bigger and more powerful and occupy a larger role and occupy a bigger percentage of the gross national product of the United States, and eventually can turn us all into just mindless slaves. And I'll digress, but, Elon Musk has now had his Neuralink implanted in some guy's brain. It's a human being. It was bad enough when he was teaching monkeys to play Pong with their brains. But you imagine putting chips in a human being's brain to allow them to manipulate things just by thought. Now, that sounds wonderful, right? I had an older brother who was paralyzed in a car accident and looking towards a lifetime of paralysis and limitation, he chose to take his own life. And so you being able to control things with your mind seems like a wonderful idea. But think about the reverse. If the chip in your mind can cause you to control things with just thoughts, can that chip in your brain be used to provide you with the thoughts? I mean, that is the inevitable end result of having this cybernetic combination of human beings and machinery that it'll be introduced into society on the basis of saying this will help human beings that are paralyzed or brain injured, and we can give them control back over their lives. But in the real world, what it's going to do is give the powers that be control over your mind by giving you the ideas, by controlling your thought process. If a Supreme Court justice thinks that we need to be controlled, that our thoughts need to be controlled, that our information has to be safeguarded by encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information, what do you think that judge would say about a brain implant that keeps you from thinking harmful things? I mean, of course that's where this is headed, and it's where we're going to go. But the world is completely, totally upside down now. You know, if you're an American citizen living in state of Illinois, New York City, Washington, D.C., any of the other places where they have two things, rampant crime, murders, and gun control, because as my bumper sticker used to say, when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. But in all these cities, which have the strictest gun control laws, they also have the highest crime rates. It's almost like people commit crimes where they know they're not going to get their asses shot off if they come up against somebody. But guess what? A U.S. district judge in the Northern District of Illinois just slapped down a rule. I mean, it's been the law for a long time that illegal aliens can't be in possession of a gun, right? She says that that's unconstitutional. Actually, what this judge said, that it had always been held constitutional, that illegal aliens didn't have constitutional rights. When I was going to law school way back, you know, when Abraham Lincoln was running for re-election, there was one thing that was absolutely clear, and that is that people legally in the country had rights. People who are illegally in the country do not have rights. If you're an illegal alien, you don't have constitutional rights because only American citizens and people here legally have those constitutional rights. Just makes sense, right? But if you're in Illinois and you're an honest citizen and you want to carry a gun, you can't do it. If you're in D.C. and you want to carry a gun, you can't do it. If you're in New York City and you want to carry a gun, you can't do it. If you're a legal, God-fearing, law-abiding American citizen, you can't do it. They won't issue a permit. On the other hand, if you're an illegal alien, and this guy, who is the subject of this litigation, he got charged with amongst other things, the crime of being an illegal alien in possession of a weapon. But he was in downtown Chicago shooting his gun off, right? Randomly at some white vehicle. And so he gets charged with this crime of being an illegal in possession. And the judge says, that's unconstitutional, that his right to bear arms is guaranteed by the Second Amendment. Well, tell it to the law-abiding citizens of Illinois. Don't tell it to the illegal alien who's shooting randomly in downtown Chicago. That's bad, but that's not the worst. District of Columbia now allows non-citizens to vote, all right? So you can carry a gun if you're a non-citizen, but you can't if you are a citizen. And in D.C., you can now vote in municipal elections if you're an illegal alien. So let's pick this apart a little bit, all right? An illegal alien in states where you don't have to, or District of Columbia where you don't have to show any, you know, valid ID to vote. You can be an illegal alien. You could be a terrorist. You could be the leader of a drug cartel and show up in downtown D.C. and say, I want to vote in this election. And the government says, sure. You go to Chicago. You say, you know, I'd like to be able to own a gun here. I'm a unregistered illegal alien terrorist, but it's unconstitutional to deny me the right to carry a gun. Well, you know, if I want to go out and buy a gun, you got to go to a gun store. You got to fill out this federal form 4473 that asks you all kinds of things like, are you a felon? Are you a citizen? Are you habituated to any kind of illegal drugs? All these kinds of things. You got to fill it out. They send it in to the instant record check. And if the government says you're okay, based on the information that you've got on that form, then you're allowed to buy that gun, all right? Or if they don't respond within 3 days, it's waived and you can buy the gun. Think about what happens with an illegal alien, though. Do they have a record check? Do they have an ID? I mean, my wife and I have been there on the border watching Customs and Border Patrol process these people through. On the Mexican side of the barrier is everybody's ID, their wallets, even their cash. On the American side, when they walk in, they get a Ziploc bag with their new ID, their debit card, and their cell phone. When that person then ends up in the Northern District of Illinois and wants to carry a gun, when they fill out a 4473, well, of course not, because they're criminals who are here illegally. But if they did fill out a 4473, the FBI couldn't do a record check on them because they don't have a record in this country. And the, pardon my language, and Ken's going to write this down right now, the shithole country they come from won't keep any records because they're shithole countries, right? They don't keep records of their criminals. And by the way, they're sending their criminals here to get rid of them. They're emptying their insane asylums. They're emptying their prisons. And they're sending them to the United States so they can vote in our election and shoot up downtown Chicago. Ladies and gentlemen, this is insanity. As I said last week, why would any honest American put up with this for a second? Why would you ever vote for a congressman that goes up to Congress, votes for more spending, and allows this kind of insanity to take place? Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's stand up and say, hell no, we're not going to tolerate it anymore. And the best way to do that, vote for Donald Trump. We'll do a house cleaning and we'll fix this mess.
Join Mark McCloskey in the battle against globalism. This is Mark McCloskey on Fire.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.